Well, it's time for Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najel. Thanks for joining us today. We're taking a look at some new varieties of plants that you might like to add to your landscape. And if you're like me, you will. It's always fun to have Melinda Myers back with us. She is nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author, and columnist with over 30 years of horticulture experience. Melinda will be back at State Fair this year, too, and she's going to tell us about that. Have you found a great new variety this year? Do you have any gardening questions? Well, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, Melinda.
Hi, Jill. Always great to chat with you and your listeners.
Likewise, I am sure. You know, and I was reading that, and, you know, we've been writing, you have over 30 years of horticulture experience for quite a while now. Is there more to add, or would you prefer not to talk about it?
You know, I'm pretty proud. I'm upright and standing. It's actually been 46 years since I moved to Wisconsin.
Wow.
And started working with gardeners in the state and around the country. So I am pretty proud of that, though. Diana, who you know, who does PR, goes, maybe we should not let people know.
They're expecting someone 102. Well, maybe we should change it just many, many years of horticulture experience.
Okay, I like
okay,
that.
How does that
and
sound?
She was very young when she started.
That's right. So. Only five.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you could make it. We appreciate it. So, yeah, you know, we wanted to talk a little bit about some new varieties of plants. Now, how do you find them, Melinda?
You know, I'm lucky enough that because of what I get to do, working with gardeners and writing and doing interviews with folks like you, a lot of companies will approach me and send me samples and let me try some things. And then I have friends in the industry, too, that, you know, go, oh, I've had really good luck with this. You should try it. And I'm like all the other gardeners. I go to the garden center often, and I usually leave with a full cart and try something. It's like, oh, that looks really cool. I haven't grown that before. And so I'm lucky enough to have a variety. And gardeners then, too, share with me, oh, have you tried this? It's really good. So, I think like everybody else that, you know, puts their hands in the soil, we're always looking for some new fun and different things, maybe more disease and insect resistant, maybe just cool or, you know, more productive.
Sure. So what do you look for when you're going to bring a new variety into your garden?
You know, I'm a low maintenance gardener like so many people. I love to garden, but, you know, none of us have as much time as we want to do everything we'd like to do. So I like things, if I'm looking for flowers, of course, that support pollinators, attract hummingbirds, provide food for songbirds, but are very low maintenance. So I'm not going to deadhead. You know, I love daylilies, and I put them in my yard where the faded flowers don't bother me, and I enjoy the bloom, and it's good. But I'm not going to get out there every day and remove that faded bloom.
Oh, yeah, you and I both. I just, you know, you don't have time. And my philosophy is that if it looks good when I open my door and I look at my yard, it looks good from there, I'm happy.
I'm with you. If we could figure out the weed situation, we'd both be better off.
Gosh.
And then when it comes to vegetables, disease resistance, and productivity.
Sure.
You know, I was a small space gardener for many, many years, and I still do a lot of containers, so it's convenient. And then I have a larger garden. I plant and try new things and then grow, you know, produce
sure.
to enjoy.
Yeah.
So anything that's going to make it through our crazy weather is good for me, too.
And it just keeps changing.
It does. Exactly.
How long do you have to have it in your garden for you to consider it a success?
You know, well, if it makes it through the first winter, well, maybe the first growing season,
uh-huh.
where that's a good plus, right?
Yeah.
And then through winter. And this winter, and I know I'm not alone, and I hope you didn't lose things, but I lost some established plants.
I did,
that
too.
I was really surprised. You know, it was fluctuating temperatures, very little snow. You know, this summer has been 90-something, and then, you know, down in the low 60s, up and down. And so I think I've been asking gardeners, and I'm doing the same, really evaluating plants that in the past have done pretty well for me and, boy, just aren't performing as well as I would like this year, surprised. So, you know, if it's a perennial, I like to give it a few years. If it's an annual, how did it perform from when I planted to the first killing frost or a light freeze if it was, you know, a hardy annual. But, you know, with the perennials, some are short-lived, some are long-lived, some recede readily and take over the garden. Those get moved out.
Okay. Well, with that criteria down, we will talk to you about some of your favorite new varieties, but we do have some phone calls. So Jean has been waiting for a while. So go ahead, Jean in Menominee.
Hi. During our strawberry production season, for a couple years now, we've had some heavy rains, and that's caused all the strawberries to go mushy. Is there any way of protecting the strawberry plants during heavy rains so that the strawberries don't get ruined?
You know, this is another thing that there's with the whole thing with our weather, right? We are having torrential downpours, which really limits. And in Menominee Falls, you have some heavy clay soil, most of the garden areas there. And so the only thing you could do is create a tarp, you know, to kind of push the water away from your strawberry bed. How practical is that? Probably not too much. As you are establishing new beds or renovating an old planting bed, just making sure that you've got good organic matter to encourage good drainage. You may want to evaluate your mulch also. I mean, mulching is great not only for suppressing weeds, for protecting the soil when we have heavy rains, but it does conserve moisture and keeps the soil wet longer. So you may want to evaluate your mulching situation as well. So other than putting some kind of cover over, kind of like your garden umbrella type thing when it's going to rain, you know, maybe if you have bird netting or something over your planting, maybe you can, you know, just throw a tarp over for the heavy rain, take it off so you don't cook the plants underneath and they get the light they need. But soil improvement is really the only long-term solution, and it may be somewhat limited with the kind of weather we're having.
Very true. I did just see a story recently about cherry growers in Washington State, I believe it was. They hire helicopters after a rain to blow off the water in their orchards. Yeah.
So Jean may be getting a little drone going over.
Exactly.
So Jean, if you find another solution, we would love to hear about
it. I'm thinking
wild
leaf blower. Fan. Anyway.
Well, you know, drying the plants off faster, your soil would still be pretty wet.
But yeah.
It might. You know, and you want to make sure you're not blowing the flowers off and,
It could,
doing any damage.
Don't take my advice. I'm amateur here.
Thinking, you know, Jill, you might be onto something. Let us know if you find another solution. Wish I had kind of a, you know, this will work for sure idea.
Yep. You never know. Let's go to Gianni and Montello. Go on, Gianni.
Yes. Well, we're avid gardeners, and we have about a 1,200 square foot garden. About 5 years ago, I brought in a lot of horse manure, and with that, never before happened, but we brought in apparently a lot of quackgrass and crabgrass. So I have a theory. We've got to do something about this. This year has been the weeds have been very aggressive. So if I were to let the garden go fallow next year and in mid-July hit it with Roundup, would I be reducing the weed population for the following year?
You know, I don't know that I would wait that long. And a couple of things, I just want to mention Roundup has changed their formulation. In most places I'm seeing it, it has diquat and something else in it, no longer glyphosate. So you might want to do a little research and see how comfortable you are with the new ingredients for Roundup. At least I haven't been able to find it with the glyphosate. You may want to, if you want to go, here's what I would do. Once you harvest your garden, I would probably do one application of a total vegetation killer to kind of slow it down. And then this is if you want to use chemicals. We'll talk non-chemicals in a minute. And then you may need to do a couple of applications, you know, starting in the spring as things are coming up, and then probably again mid-season. And here's why, because quackgrass, you know, with the crabgrass, that's sort of easy compared to quackgrass to control. But quackgrass has those long rhizomes that looks like a long white root. Any little piece of that can start a new plant. So when you use a total vegetation killer, you'll probably get some control, but it probably won't take out the whole rhizome. And so new grass, quackgrass plants will sprout from that. The other thing is crabgrass, you're going to want to make sure you hit it if you are going to treat it instead of weeding, you know, hand pulling it before it goes to seed. So I'm guessing that's why you were thinking midsummer to treat. If for those folks, I don't, and maybe I should let you, if you had any questions on that before I talk about non-chemical options for some folks that may not want to use a total vegetation killer.
Did you have any questions, Jenny?
Okay.
The quackgrass, is that an invasive species? Was that brought here in the 1850s as a forage for dairy farms, or
I know at one point, maybe like 30 years ago, they were talking about it being a potential forage crop. I don't know if that's how it ended up here. I apologize. I should know. It is terrible. I have it too. And it's, you know, you pull and you pull and you dig and you dig and it's still coming back. And so it is. And then there was some feeling that quackgrass clippings might be useful in slug control. You know, I think we keep trying to find some reason to have it or deal with it. But it is very aggressive. It spreads, as you know, anyone fighting quackgrass. What I would suggest in your garden bed is to edge your bed, and that disconnects it in case you've got quackgrass in the surrounding lawn area. And even adding an extra foot so that it's another foot that quackgrass and grass has to go to get into your garden. Edge that, cover it with, if you want to do clear plastic for 6 weeks, it sounds like you're willing to give up your garden next summer. Kansas State University found solarization 6 to 8 weeks of the hottest weeks in the summer, which for us is usually July and August, who knows, that not only kills the surface, what's growing above, but it then goes into the soil deeper. Doing an opaque thing like black plastic or weed barrier, that kind of thing, you'll need to leave it on all season to smother the weeds below. So for people looking for a non-chemical option, that would be something to take a look at.
Okay, good luck on that, Gianni. That's definitely not fun. I did a quick Google search, and according to their AI overview, quackgrass was likely introduced to North America and the Midwest through transportation of infested hay and straw during the 1600s and 1700s. So it's been here for a very, very long time. So
thank you, Jill. I appreciate that.
Great. Anytime.
I'll remember that now.
Yes. Well, Melinda Myers is our guest today. What questions do you have for her? Give us a call. 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jill Nagel. Coming up in the last half hour of the show, we'll talk about fertilizer and the different types and their shelf life. Right now, we're talking to Melinda Myers about everything. But one of the things we asked her here to do was talk about some of the new varieties that she's particularly liking. So let's talk about a couple of those before we go back to the phones.
Well, last year, I added Pink Diamond Dicentra. It's a bleeding heart, a fern leaf bleeding heart that likes full sun. I first saw it at Walter's Garden at their trial gardens, bought some plants for my garden, and we put one in at State Fair. They bloom all summer. They like full sun, something most of us, you know, bleeding hearts like some partial shade. The leaves hold up. Well, they just introduced a white diamond. So I've got that in my garden. So I'll have to report next year to see how it did. But the pink diamonds are looking great. And I have lots of sun where I live now. And so this was a nice addition for me.
And again, and so it was pink diamond.
Pink diamonds and now white diamonds, Dicentra, Fernleaf Bleeding Heart.
Beautiful.
Dicentra. Yeah, it is beautiful. I'm testing Incredible Storm Proof, which is a type of smooth hydrangea, an Annabelle-type hydrangea. Incrediballs were bred to have this huge flower, and we have some of those at the gardens at We Energy Energy Park at State Fair. But this one has got a little bit smaller, round flowers, and then it grows about 4 feet tall and wide, but stiffer stems, so it's not going to flop over like so many of the hydrangeas do. So mine's still in the pot. I'm taking it to State Fair. So it hasn't done the test in my garden yet, but it's one to watch for. You know, I think as gardeners, sometimes we take a chance, but then sometimes we like to just wait and see.
That's right.
You know, for small space gardeners, or if you just like to do, you know, maybe a hanging basket of tomatoes on your patio, or your deck, or your balcony, Burpee's Ball Horticulture introduced red and orange sugar basket tomatoes. And these only grow about 12, mine's about 15, one's about 15 inches in a hanging basket that I'm taking to fair, and the other one's about 12 inches in an elevated garden mixed with other plants. So about 1-inch diameter cherry tomatoes. I've had a couple. They're tasty. And it's good for small space. You know, instead of a hanging basket of flowers, maybe have a hanging basket of tomatoes.
That's a great idea. Yeah, that's a great idea. Okay. Well, let's save the rest of them, Melinda. We've got a few more calls. Surprise, surprise.
Great.
Let's go to Dot in Manitowoc. She's been waiting for a while. Go ahead, Dot.
Oh, good morning. I have learned so many things from your previous caller. I have a garden plot that's it's about 50-50 of vegetables to grow, but I'm only going to use a portion of that. Now, I would like to put the solarization on the part that I'm not using. Now, do I buy that white plastic at the hardware store, or how about a tarp that is maybe black or the gray? Could I use that and still keep the soil healthy?
That's a great question, and that's one of the problems when we do tarp our soil, right? Because the water doesn't get through and the air doesn't get through, and it does damage our soil. Solarization depends on the sunlight going through. So think about sitting in your car in the winter and it's a sunny day. You actually get pretty warm because of the sun. And so that's what you're doing with the clear plastic. And why I like solarization a little bit better than, you know, using some dark cover to smother is it's a shorter period. It's like 6 to 8 weeks. And you could probably, with the way our weather is going now, you know, we've often have some pretty hot weather now through fall. And so you may want to take that half that you're not using. Let's get some clear, heavy-duty plastic. I've used this on some raised beds where I had created these beds from sod that I was clearing out to make a new garden, turned it upside down, you know, added some fertilizer, stacked it high, covered it with clear plastic to kill the grass. And I've had fairly good success, not 100%, because the plastic tore and I wasn't good. You need to secure the, you know, good intentions. Yeah. You need to secure the edge too, Dot, so that it really captures the heat. If you're going to use, if you're going to just cover it with a dark tarp, you could use anything. Some people use cardboard. And cover and then mulch, and that works great too. Cut any weeds really short, edge the garden bed, throw down cardboard, and throw mulch mainly to keep it in place, or use landscape pins to keep it in place. Not always as effective because often the weeds will creep in underneath, but that will work as well. That's a good mulch in between your rows of vegetables too. A lot of gardeners use newspaper. Very little newspaper out there anymore.
True.
Or cardboard, right? And then throw some mulch on top, some shredded leaves or something. And that really can do a good job of helping keep the weeds down, especially the annuals, not as much with quackgrass. So that I would say, if you're going to solarize, get clear plastic, a heavy-duty clear plastic, edge the bed, anchor it securely. I would do it soon so you could take care of that half of the garden now. What a great idea, Dot. And then next year you could treat the other half and plant the one that you did. You'll probably not get 100% just because weed seeds and weeds coming in, but boy, it'll really let you get ahead of all that weed population that's already there.
Yeah, good luck, Dot. I've done the, I'm doing the cardboard with mulch on top right now, and it's been working really, really well. I'm doing with my perennial bed that was just out of control. So,
and that is a great idea.
Yeah, it works
and
well.
And the other thing I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. The other
thing
say is consider cover crops. I've got an area that I've kind of not planted this year, and I'm going to put cover crops in this fall, you know, get some of the thistles out of there that are in there, and then plant the cover crop to put some of the nutrients back in. I have very sandy soil, add organic matter, but then keep the weeds at bay too. And so you want to be careful selecting cover crops. Some are really aggressive. Clover's great, adds nitrogen, but it's aggressive and sometimes hard to kill, right?
Yes.
So do a little research first, but, you know, you may want to check that out, especially if you have areas like Dot where, you know, I'm not going to get this planted this year, so maybe I'll plant a cover crop in the spring or in the fall, you know, soon to then dig under in the spring, and then your garden will be in good shape. So that's another option if you want to skip the chemicals.
Yeah, green fertilizer. I love it.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phone. Susan in Madison, go right ahead.
Yes, I have a beautiful terrace that was built 30 years ago. It consists of 18-inch squares of cement, and interspersed are flat slabs of stone. Over many 30 years, I've pulled weeds out of it because it was based on sand and gravel and whatever. And last summer, I got tired of pulling the weeds out, and I couldn't bend down very well. So I had a gardener who decided that she would pull out, root and all the weeds that were growing in the cracks. Well, I didn't know quite how to refurbish the spaces that had been emptied of weeds and roots. And now, a year later, I have all kinds of new weeds growing in the cracks. What is the procedure for getting rid of weeds and cracks and then refurbishing the under pavement before it all goes, it all collapses and the patio has to be relayed?
Yeah, and I'm gonna help you with the weed situation and then probably direct you to more of a landscaper because I don't do hardscapes and so I don't want to give you bad advice that way. But what I'll do with my patio and my pavers is I do one of two things. I have these really deluxe like box cutter X-Acto knives where I can just cut right to the ground level if you don't want to treat. I understand the whole bending over. It gets to be pretty tedious. I'll use plant-based weed and plant killers, grass and weed killers, but they kill anything but just burn off the top so they don't kill the roots. So you'll have to do several applications, and you need to avoid your good plants because it can damage those. But they use plant oils or soaps at a high concentration to burn the top of the plants. And one reason I do that is, you know, we're all walking on the surface. Yours is different. But that way I avoid having pesticides, you know, picked up in my feet and things like that. I'm just worried about, I think if you can find a good landscaper in your area or if you know a friend that's done a lot of hardscapes, I don't know, Jill, if you have any guests that come on that talk about this kind of thing.
We just had someone from Hawks on a couple weeks ago. I don't remember that came up, but I know that you can buy like a sand that's specifically made for putting between your blocks. But yeah, I think contacting a landscaper and getting the lowdown would be a really good idea.
Yeah, and with the being a terrace, I'm not sure how you get it in and keep it in there. So
yeah.
That is the advantage of just killing the tops and leaving the roots,
yeah,
because those roots do hold the material in place.
What are your thoughts
and
on
eventually decompose?
What are your thoughts on boiling water? I've seen that a lot from people, to put boiling water on those. You're cooking them, you're killing them, but again, the roots aren't really being done. But
right,
it's safe.
I think basically, I think it's not going to hurt anything. So that's, it's not going to, sorry,
that's
just trying
true
to turn off a text message, pretty creepy music. I'm not sure. Sometimes we think if you could get it under your sink, it's better. And, you know, it's not going to hurt anything. It's mm-hmm kind of like when you do that for ants, they move to another place.
Right.
You're just going to probably kill the tops. And, you know, it's kind of like the vinegar thing, too.
Yeah, yeah.
With the vinegar, I worry about the impact on the soil. There's
yes
been some research that there's concern that way. But, yeah, I see a lot of hacks coming out and a lot, well, I did this and it worked. And I kind of prefer the more research-based or products
sure
that have had to go through some testing. So,
yeah. That's kind of what I was thinking, too. So,
yeah.
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 But, like you said, it's not going to hurt anything, but, you know, it's a lot of hot water
right
to boil.
Is
so
it going to work?
Exactly.
Yeah, except maybe you, so be careful. Boiling water.
Yeah.
Managing could be dangerous, dangerous for the gardener. Than
true.
The
true. Well, thank you, Susan, for that call. We really appreciate it. And now we've got Marty in Lake Geneva with a question.
Good morning. Actually, two questions. Hopefully, they're brief enough. In the past, I've read about weed and feed that you want to do it right after a rain, just before a rain, which, you know, seemed logical to me because then the rain comes down, it'll wash the weed and feed down closer to whatever. Fast forward to a few weeks ago, I decided to read the instructions for whatever reason. It was exactly the opposite. You want to let it rain and then get out there right after that and apply the weed feed. My question is, for first question is, what say B? And then the second question, and I'm going to preface that with, I tend to overthink things. I'm going to cut the lawn this afternoon. And then the next thought was, well, why would you want to do that? Because the leaves or the weeds are bigger, so they would absorb more weed and feed. So, you know, don't cut the lawn until you weed and feed. Your thoughts? And I'll listen to your answer off air.
Okay, great question. So one is I'm really glad you read the label, and it's, I know it's a practice not everybody follows, but I get a lot of calls going, I've applied this thing, and then I read the label and found that I shouldn't have done it, right?
Yeah.
So good for you for reading it first. So the reason, and every product's different. Like, I think you all know I work with Milorganite. It does not need water to work its way into the soil to be activated. Some products do recommend you water after. You do want the soil, you don't want the plants to be moisture stressed. If they're getting enough water, they're going to pull up the chemicals. If it's the fertilizer, the type of fertilizer, depending on the fertilizer, and the weed killer, so they'll be able to absorb it, and you'll have more effective control that way. When they're drought stressed, they're not pulling up water, and so they're not going to. It's not going to be as effective. Cutting the grass, the benefit. If you've got a lot of clippings on the ground, if you cut the grass, I'd let those short clippings break down a little while. Otherwise, if it's not too long, again, you're going to get good cut. If you get good coverage, you wouldn't want to be doing it now. And I don't know that you were planning on doing a weed and feed now. You don't want to do an herbicide in the summer because you're going to end up feeding the weeds probably more than the grass because of the hot temperatures. And sometimes when we hit high temperatures, sometimes you can damage your grass as well. So I'm not assuming you were doing it this summer, but somebody out there may be thinking, oh, I should weed and feed now. One of the downsides of weed and feed, and this is I'm getting into Doug Soldat's area, and he's our UW turf specialist, excellent guy. Tune in when he's on. He's got great sustainability and organic lawn care information. Good guy to listen to. But we really, when we fertilize and when we control for weeds for optimum benefit from both, it's usually at different times. And so doing your fertilizer separate and then doing your weed killer when it's the best time for the weed you're controlling. And, you know, considering spot treating, you know, unless your whole lawn is affected, you may just have certain areas and you can use a lot less weed killer that way than applying it to the whole lawn.
Great. Now, I did, in fact, just book Doug. He will be
coming
in, but not till September because he's a busy guy. But if anybody wants to hear, you can just go to WPR.org/Larry and look at our archives or search for Doug Soldat, S-A-O-L-D-A-T, and all of his shows will come up and you can, you know, learn everything that Doug knows. So, yeah.
And I just want to inject, he has some great publications online also on sustainability, organic. And then just, you know, if you are okay using chemicals, he talks about how to use them at the proper times to get the best benefit, too. So you've got that written information available through UW as well.
That's right. We're talking to Melinda Myers. If you have any questions, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. That's talk@WPR.org. And we did have a listener email to say that their ever-bearing raspberry leaves are yellow and have small holes. They haven't seen any insects on the plants, but they cut the plants down in early spring, so this is all new growth. Do you think it's an insect problem, a mineral deficiency, or possibly both? They live in northeastern Wisconsin with heavy clay soils.
You know, there's a couple things to watch for. I've been finding a lot of plant bug damage on things, and these insects have piercing, sucking mouth parts, and they leave little brown dots. And sometimes when an insect feeds, that tissue dies, or even in a disease, and drops out. When I hear yellow leaves, I usually think of cane blight some of those, and those typically affect, proper pruning will take care of it. We usually don't need a fungicide, and typically you'll get some yellowing. The fact you've got holes happening, I'm wondering if you've got two different problems, an insect problem as well as a disease problem. It sounds like you're doing a good job in your pruning, so if you've got everbearing, assuming as soon as you finished harvesting or will finish harvesting your raspberries, the summer crop, that you'll cut those back to the ground level. That increases airflow, so you have fewer problems. There are some insects that will attack the cane borers as well. You'll see a little swelling, and that can cause the area above to yellow and eventually brown and die. Yeah, I'm going to give a plug for UW. Growing raspberries in Wisconsin not only tells you how to grow them and manage and train them, and then also pruning, which can be a little confusing when you're new to growing raspberries. They also have good information on the diseases and insects and some nice line drawings as well to help kind of guide you through that process. So, you know, you may want to, if it's a whole planting and you're a little concerned, send a sample into the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. There is a fee for email pictures as well as sending a sample in. You may just want to look at the publication first and then decide, oh, yeah, it's this and my pruning and it's the best thing I can do, and maybe end it there. I have to tell you, Jill, I had aster yellows on some coneflowers, and I kind of knew they were, but I was hoping when I sent my sample in that Brian would tell me differently. And he didn't. And I had to get rid of them. And, you know, so it's easy for me to say, I'll pull it out and just wait. And, I had to live, you know, when it's your own garden, it hurts worse.
It does. And he said that it's pretty, he's seen a lot of that this year. So,
this was last year's garden. Okay. And, you know, so I'm kind of monitoring. So I did get rid of them right away when I found out the bad news.
That's hard.
I am starting to see a lot of powdery mildew, which we, right now, a ton of powdery mildew. I haven't seen Japanese beetles, but I'm seeing a lot of damage that's similar to Japanese beetles. So there's something else I haven't found yet. I've got to go out and look for to see what's bunching on.
I've had that and a couple of new plants I put in, and I don't know what the heck is going on with them. But yeah, me too. I can't seem to see a bug of any sort. No Japanese beetles this year so far, knock on wood. Yeah,
I know.
There's always something out there.
There is. You might want to check. I didn't, you know, last year earwigs were huge problems. Mm. I haven't seen too many out and about, but they're like slugs. They feed at night.
Uh-huh.
They like cool, dark, damp places to hide, and they eat a variety of things. And last year, they were devastating. I've never seen the damage. So, it's take a flashlight out just as it's getting dark and see if you can, that's what I need to do.
There
see who's
go.
Out there munching away.
And enjoy the fireflies while you're out there.
Yes. Oh, aren't they great this
oh,
year?
Oh my gosh, they're so beautiful. I just can't get enough of them. They're wonderful. We're going to take another quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk some more about the plant varieties that you wanted to share with us. So have those ready, Melinda. We are talking to nationally known gardening expert Melinda Myers. Give us a call if you have a question, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up in the last half hour of the show, we're going to talk about fertilizer, so hope you can stick with us. And then on Monday on the Larry Mueller Show, we'll talk about new ultra-fast X-ray lasers and what they are being used for. It's pretty cool. But right now, we're talking to Melinda Myers, and she's got some really cool new varieties to share with us. Go ahead, Melinda.
Well, if you like black-eyed Susan vine, you know that you can get it yellow with a black center. It's a Thunbergii, or you can get orange. Well, there's a new one called Coconut Appeal, and it's white with a black eye. And I picked this up at a garden center, and the owner said this. He's seen this perform very well. It's doing great for me. I have it in a hanging basket, and it's been blooming, no deadheading needed. And I've kind of had problems in the past with heat really being a problem in the intense sunlight where I live now with the other black-eyed Susan vines, and this one's doing well. The other one you may have seen in the garden centers, it's called Monarch Magic Ageratum or floss flower. It's a purple one. It's a trailer, and supposedly it's supposed to attract monarchs better than other ageratums. And the company, Ball Horticulture, that introduced it, this is the story I got, is looking into the genetics to see what it is about this particular ageratum that makes it more attractive. And one garden center I went to visit said, yeah, they had the doors open, you know, when the weather was changing and it was getting warm, and they found monarchs on their ageratum in the garden, in the greenhouse. So that's cool.
That is cool.
And
now,
are those
both perennials or are those annuals?
These are all annuals. I'm sorry. So we're back into the annual area. I should have prefaced that.
When you said hanging basket, I kind of assumed, but hey.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's the last one?
And the last one are the whole Soiree Flamingo Vincas. Vincas kind of remind me of impatience, but they like full sun. They're drought tolerant, heat tolerant. The flamenco, Soiree Flamingo, have really unique flowers, double ruffled ruffled petals, fringed petals, new bicolors, and they're very cool. So I'm going to have some of those on display at the fair for people to check out.
Nice, nice. And speaking of the fair, kind of go over a little bit about where you're going to be, what you're going to be talking about, that type of thing.
Well, and the good news is I just checked and we just uploaded the details for my three talks that I'm doing. So
I'm at
We Energy, Energy Park, and located on Whitley Way. And it's just, it's a wonderful, wonderful event. And I'm lucky enough, this has been over 20 years that I've been doing it.
Wow.
I know, exactly. I am old. But at 10:45, I'm going to talk companion planting, and our feature garden has some examples of plants that partner well to help with pest management and improving the soil. 1:30, I'll talk about these and more new varieties and have them on display. And at 4:00, vertical gardening. Some DIYs that I did for our library program this spring, I'll have on hand to show and tell. and then just talk about the benefits and some good plants for doing vertical gardening. And, of course, answering questions after every presentation.
Yeah, and that area at State Fair Park, it's like it is an oasis away. It's a good place to kind of, like, take a breath, right?
It is. And if you've got kids, the Discovery World is doing a really cool thing where you can make a little pollinator, battery, solar-powered pollinator. You can decorate the wings of a bee or bee or butterfly. And then Schlitz Audubon, of course, is there with the Birds of Prey, and they do a great show. So there's lots of things. And like you said, green space.
Yeah.
People have proposed at that site. It's been fun to see how people enjoy We Energy Park.
Yeah, very neat. Always a fun time, and hopefully it won't be too hot or too rainy.
Exactly. We can only hope.
Let's go back to the phones. Mike and Hudson, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, hi, thank you. I listened to part of the conversation about turf earlier, and I don't know if I missed it. Was there any discussion about making sure people take a soil sample down to the UW lab for analysis?
You know what? Thank you. I did not mention that, and shame on me, Mike. So very good point. Frank Rossi, who used to be our turf specialist, he's now in Cornell. And some of his recent work has been showing that old established lawns, if you leave your clippings on, lawns have been fertilized, probably need little, if any, additional fertilizer. If you leave your clippings, that's equal to one fertilization. You know, maybe it's just one additional one. And you're right, Mike, a soil test will tell you what, if any, nutrients and what analysis you need. So thank you. I'm so glad that you brought that up, Mike. And UW Soils Lab, you can go online, tells you how to take a sample, where to send it, and all the details. Thank you so much, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely, because you don't want to fertilize if you don't need to. We don't need more of that in our water system, right?
Exactly. And then one of the easy things that's often overlooked is sweeping all your clippings and your fertilizer back on the lawn. I think we've all seen places where people shoot the grass clippings into the street.
Oh, yes.
Dangerous, but it's also bad for water quality. Clippings or fertilizer back on your lawn. So you're absolutely right. It's about water quality. By doing it right, and you'll have a better lawn, too. But you'll also take better care of the environment, bringing down just what type of fertilizer and the amount that you need.
Yeah, you can do both. So that's a win-win.
Right.
Jim in Hollandale, go ahead. It's your turn.
I'm wondering how to keep onions over the winter.
So a couple things with onions. First of all, harvesting properly, and this is probably review for you, but maybe some people are growing onions for the first time. So when the tops fall over naturally, that's a good sign they're ready to harvest. Those started from plants, whether you started them or bought the transplant, store longer than those started from sets. But, I've had decent luck saving both for a while. Then after, if it's a dry period, some people will dig their onions and leave them out in the garden to dry. I have shelving racks on wheels that I use to dry my garlic and my onion in my garage just because it always seems to rain after harvest. So I let them cure, and then, you can clip off, leave a little space above the onion bulb. You don't want to damage it, and the papery covering intact. And if you've got excess roots, just lightly removing the soil and then store it in a cool, dark place, preferably well ventilated. You could buy harvest racks. Some people use old bulb crates, but a dark, cool, dark location. And I've had luck keeping my onions into March and I'm still having good success with them. And so that's kind of some of the key is proper harvest time, proper curing so that they're nice and dry, and then use anything that's damaged. You're probably better than me, Jim, but I always seem to spear an onion or two. Those get used right away along with the potatoes that I accidentally cut when I'm digging. Those things will help you keep them longer.
So what is your clue that those onions are ready to store?
It's usually you kind of feel them. They should still be firm, not dried out and shriveled, but they should be nice and firm, but the outside kind of dry. So it's usually for garlic, it can be a couple of weeks. For onions, it's usually a week is usually sufficient. But that's a really good question. That's why I leave the tops on, because when the tops are totally dry, that's usually a good sign that now they've closed up, they've kind of sealed up, and they're ready to go. So when you dig them, that's why a lot of people just leave tops and all, put it in the garden. But it seems like it always rains for me. So I store mine in the garage on a rack. And then, you know, when your tops are good and dry, that's usually a good sign they're ready to store.
Excellent. We got an email from Pat in Madison, and they couldn't stay with us, but apparently Pat has successfully filled in cracks, because we were talking earlier about a terrace, with polymeric sand, and it's spelled P-O-L-Y-M-E-R-I-C, and you mix it with water, and it solidifies. Probably not forever, but so that's what you want to look for if you want to be a do-it-yourselfer. So,
and it's supposed to keep the weeds out, too, that sand. And because it's, I haven't used it, but because it is liquid, then thank you, Pat. That's probably going to allow her, our previous caller, to put them into her wall. That's what the part I wasn't sure how to keep it in there. So thank you, Pat. That's great.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We learned so much from our listeners also, as well as our guests. Let's go to the back to the phone with Mary in Green Bay. Go ahead, Mary.
Oh, hello. Thanks for being on with us, Melinda. I am out in my garden, and on the northeast side, I have a garden full of heliopsis, and mixed with them on the edge of the garden is Turk's head lilies, the orange kind with the spots.
Oh, nice.
And I was, they're beautiful. I looked out there yesterday or the day, I guess last week too, and I noticed some leaves were being leaves being bitten. Then I looked at the buds and the blossoms. Oh my God, they're being destroyed. And this morning, there's whole stems that are gone, no leaves at all. And the only bugs I see right now in daylight are three little red, very shiny bugs. About the size of the seed head.
Yep.
But
and
you mentioned earwigs.
Yeah, I think
I
we know
what I've got.
Yeah, we know what we got. Go ahead, Melinda.
It sounds like red lily beetle from the type of damage. And that's what I'm guessing you were thinking too, Jill. The larvae as well as the adults will eat holes and do exactly the kind of damage that you're talking about. It first was found in Wausau, Wisconsin, and it's in multiple counties throughout Wisconsin. First came to Canada around World War II. Northeast U.S. was badly infected. Some parts of Michigan, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin are seeing the problem. It will attack only true lilies, so not day lilies, but true lilies, fritillarias, Solomon seal to lesser extent, lily of the valley to a lesser extent it will attack. And they're bright red beetles. And a couple things that you can do. If it's a small population, you know, knock them into a can of soapy water. You can use horticulture oil like Summit year-round spray oil. But it has to contact the same as insecticidal soap because it covers the holes, the spiracles, where the insects breed, and that will kill them. But it won't hurt, like, if a good guy lands, a lady beetle lands on the leaf that was treated, it won't hurt them, just what it's contacted. So that's an organic option, and insecticidals will work. Sides will also work. Some people have given up growing lilies because the population has been so high and so damaging. And it's something we need to watch for. I was at a friend's, and she just for the first year had the problem. I came home and checked mine out. So far, so good. But that doesn't mean next year I won't have them. So red lily beetles, UW, PJ Leash, and Lisa Johnson did a nice publication on it, on the red lily. It's either lily leaf beetle, scarlet lily leaf beetle, or red lily leaf beetle. You'll see it all the same insect, called three different things. But lots of information on the internet on extension. And just keep after it is the best you can do, or avoid lilies for a while.
Yeah, it's nasty. And we just started hearing about it in the last few years, but it really is devastating. So Good luck with that, Mary. We will be back with more from Melinda in just a little bit. Going to take a little break for news. And then remember, coming up at 12:30, we're going to talk about fertilizer. Stay with us. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nagel. Thanks for joining us today. We've been talking with nationally known gardening expert Melinda Myers. What questions are on your mind? We still have a couple of lines open, so give us a call. 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. Melinda, we didn't get a chance to talk about companion gardening at all in the last hour. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, I think when gardeners think of companion planting, they always think of ways to manage insect pests. But I really like a broader definition of partnering plants together to not only manage pests so that you have fewer disease and insect problems, that you use less pesticides, but also how to improve the soil, increase your productivity of your vegetables. And so taking a broader view, there's a really good book by Jessica Walzer called Plant Partners, and it's science-based companion planting strategy. So, you know, that's a great place if you're looking for some information. Check it out of your library, a great option. So one of the things we try to do is show how different plants teamed up would do well together. Now, if you know squash vine borer and squash bugs, there's been some research that showed planting those with nasturtiums does help reduce the risk. Nothing eliminates it, right? But it reduces the risk. Planting basil with tomatoes, and I know that's been kind of, you know, promoted for years. Well, there is some research now that shows that the basil helps mask the smell of tomatoes and reduces the chance of tomato hornworms attacking your tomatoes and reduces the danger of thrips as well. When you look at arugula, now if you like to eat arugula, this may not be the solution for you, but those really spicy members of the cabbage family seem to attract the flea beetles better, and then it keeps them off of your cabbage and your broccoli and your Brussels sprouts. So that's fine if you don't want to eat the arugula. Now, if you do want to eat them, I'm a big fan of floating row covers. So, you know, you plant your cabbages, your broccoli, you cover it. If you haven't had that problem in that spot in the garden with floating row covers, it allows air, light, and water through. But the cabbage moths can't lay their eggs. The flea beetles can't access it. So you could have your arugula planted between, and you could have your arugula and your cabbage with fewer problems as well.
There you go.
And, you know, and then the other thing is marigolds are often promoted, but if nematodes are an issue, and luckily in Wisconsin we do have some nematodes, but it's usually not a major problem like in the South, to get the impact, the benefit, you have to dig those marigolds into the ground. So, you know, that part always got left out of the advice in the story. And so, but they do find that marigolds do help, you know, repel some insects and do some things with cucumber beetles and squash bugs, nasturtiums as well as marigolds. But if you're trying to keep the rabbits away, I've had rabbits and woodchucks eat the marigolds. So they're pretty, but don't count on it.
Right. These will only help. We did talk to Jessica Wallister about her book back when it came out
a
few years back. It was so interesting. So, yeah, I definitely agree with you. That's a great book. When you think about things like the Three Sisters, which not is vertical gardening, but it's also companion gardening, that's been happening for a long, long, long time. So,
exactly. The corn supports the beans, so that's another reason to partner, right? The squash, you know. Kind of masked the smell of the corn. So Minnesota found fewer raccoons eating the corn. That's pretty impressive.
That's very impressive.
Climbing the beans, climbing the corn, also put nitrogen in the soil. So you're right. They were the indigenous population's way ahead of us on this whole companion planting thing.
And a lot of other things, for sure.
True.
Okay, well, let's go back to the phone here. We've got Margaret in Egg Harbor with a question. Go ahead, Margaret.
My question is, we live in the woods, and I have a very small area that gets enough sun to do a garden. So I've got maybe a 25 by 20 foot garden. And the one thing that I really seem to be having trouble growing are radishes. I can't understand why, but that does seem to be, I put them in, and your companion planting is interesting because I've tried that this year for the first time. I'm still not having luck with radishes though.
You know, I'm glad you brought up radishes, Margaret, because that's a crop that a lot of gardeners have problems with. Radishes need well-drained soil. So if you're dealing with clay soil, and you've kind of had, I think you have very shallow, I'm thinking an Egg Harbor, your soil should be fairly well-drained. But one of the issues I see a lot is poor drainage. And then that prevents it thinning, making sure you thin your radishes because they need enough room for those roots to form. So that's the second problem. And then we tend to have high to excessive levels of phosphorus in our soil, but it's often tied up in our soil and not readily available. And that's where, organic fertilizers or malorganite research has found that when the microorganisms work on releasing the nutrients from the pellets, it also makes some of the phosphorus available to the plants as well as potassium. You know, Mike had mentioned a soil test before fertilizing your lawn. A soil test might help as well for you. Some folks have had great success or better success growing their root crops in containers where you've got a pot with potting mix, and radishes will take some shade, but maybe you've got a sunny spot on your patio or a deck or your front steps or someplace where you could have a container with well-drained potting mix. It would only need to be about 6 inches deep at the most, you know, a window box or something, and that might give you the better growing conditions if you don't have luck growing it in-ground in your garden.
I love that idea. I guess I never thought about putting radishes in a container.
Yeah, it's a great way to do it. And you could put it in between some of your other plants because the salad radishes only take 25 or 30 days to reach maturity. And I like to think of thinning as harvesting. I try to do a lot of gardening with kids. And, you know, we had a garden at a preschool where I had a garden, and everybody disappeared when it was time to thin except a few kids. So we were cleaning off the seedling, you know, the thinnings and eating them. And then all these kids came back, right? Oh, what are you eating? So think of it as harvesting instead of a chore.
Absolutely. They're great. They really are tasty little carrots too, right?
Oh, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking I'm going to make carrot pesto. A gardener told me it makes great pesto.
I've heard that
so
also.
On my list.
Yeah, on your list of a million things to do.
Exactly.
Now, in that same vein, we have a question from Matthew in Iron River, Michigan. Go ahead, Matthew.
Hi. So this goes along with the companion plants and the three sisters. A few years ago, I started with the beans and the corn and the squash. But I decided to also add peas just because I like them and they're, you know, nutritious and all that. But the pea plants, they start out really good and they produce some pods, but then the base of the stem, the couple inches near the ground, ends up turning yellow and kind of dies off. So the rest of the plant dies off. And I was wondering if maybe, I don't know if it's too much water or the soil, the native soil is like beach sand. So I added some manure, compost, and wood in that to try to enrich it.
So is this tend to happen as the temperatures get warmer? And I know you're further north than I am, but sometimes as the temperatures rise, our peas really start to decline. The other thing is, I was just listening to an Ask the Experts, and Brian Huddleston was talking. There are some, you know, root rot kind of diseases and things. Did your beans do okay? Did you do peas first and then followed it with beans, or just use peas?
I planted the peas early with everything else, and I waited to plant the beans. So they would climb up on plants that are the corn that's already there. The beans are doing great.
Right. Okay.
It has been very hot and very humid and then cool at night. So it's in the 50s at night and in the 80s and sometimes 90s during the day.
I wonder if it's more environmentally, especially since your beans did okay. I'd worry about a disease if your beans didn't do well. Being in the same family, often plants are very susceptible. And if everything else did okay, I'm wondering if it was more environmental. I usually do a pea planting in like early August because I never get them in early enough in the spring. I did plant some this year in an elevated garden, but boy, it was so hot. They just went downhill very quickly for me this year. So I'm hoping that a later planting with a fall harvest when it's cooler. And I'm wondering if it was more environmental than it was since your beans did okay. And I don't think the competition from the corn should have been a problem in the squash. They should have been okay together, but maybe trying your peas in another spot and just sticking with the kind of traditional three-sister mix.
Great. Okay. Well, Matthew, good luck. Hopefully that will work out for you. There's nothing like a fresh pea from the garden, that's for sure.
Oh, that's true.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What else do you like to plant in the fall, Melinda?
You know, I'm a huge fan of springs are so busy for many of us. For me, I'm busy telling gardeners what to do that I should be doing in my own garden. And so I usually get a late start planting. And so I like all the fall crops, things like radishes, carrots, beets, peas, broccoli, cabbage, Brussels sprouts. Some garden centers are now selling transplants, which is great. I have found, and probably check your farmer's market, you might have a better chance of getting some of those transplants that you could start. Katrina cabbage will be ripe in about 65 days. So if you've got space in your garden and want a fall harvest of cabbage, that would be a good one to consider, Katrina with a K. And so all those cool crops like the cabbage, the broccoli, the Brussels sprouts, they'll even tolerate a light frost. Your lettuce, 25 to 30 days. Your greens taste so much better. Spinach, when they're harvested, when it's cool, they'll take a light frost too and survive. And then I'm a big fan of row covers, not only for insect control, but also to extend the harvest. You know, when you get a later start, I'm still sometimes picking tomatoes when that first frost is in the forecast. And that's a great way to protect them. You can leave it in place except to harvest. And then when you finally are done, either having harvested everything or like, okay, the season's over, then you can remove it and use it next year if there aren't rips and tears.
Mm-hmm. They're great. They're useful for all kinds of things. How do you secure yours?
I have a lot of rocks where I live. So I usually have piles of rocks all over. So, and then some pole, you know, I have some T-posts that I keep in the garden to maybe anchor it. You can use landscape pins, which I've done too, but I kind of like the longer posts, the rocks, if I need to. I have a lot of wind, so sometimes it's multiple things. Yeah. How about you? Are you a landscape pin person?
Well, I don't really do vegetables, so I don't really need to.
You don't have to do that.
I'm very happy going to the farmer's market to get my fresh vegetables. So.
And that supports local agriculture,
yeah.
So you're doing your part. That's good, too.
That's what I always tell myself. besides, I don't have any money left over after I buy the decorative plants for my garden.
I hear you.
So Bobby emailed to say that she's heard not to prune trees this time of year because of diseases and insects. But what about the suckers coming from around the base of the tree trunk? She has some on her lilac and a hawthorn.
Yeah, so Bobby, I'm glad you brought that up. Late season pruning does a couple things. One, if we have a lot of rain, certain disease problems. For oaks, if we can avoid pruning oaks during the growing season period, it reduces the risk of oak wilt. Getting rid of the suckers is fine. One of the problems with those suckers is often they're coming from roots. Some are coming at the base of the plant, some out further. If you can prune it back below the soil surface, you'll have greater success. We usually like to say stop by August 1st. There was some research that found water sprouts on apple trees removed around end of July, early August. Again, watch the weather because apple trees are very susceptible to fire blight. had less chance of resprouting. Keep in mind, pruning eliminates, but it also encourages growth. So for the suckers, you know, it's a never-ending process.
Very true.
And I just want to mention suckering shrubs. Those new stems, like on lilacs, are multi-stem. Allowing those to develop and occasionally getting rid of the older stems is really the better way to prune. Now, on a tree like a Japanese tree lilac, yeah, you'll want to get rid of them, the suckers, because they'll compete with the main tree. You'll have a bush growing connected to the tall tree. So, you know, try to do what you need to do soon rather than later.
That's a great point with the lilacs, too, is to get rid of those old ones sometimes.
Right. We all think of suckers as bad things, but with a suckering shrub like forsythias and lilacs, if they're the, you know, shrub form, it's the older ones that are more susceptible to borers and insects. They get bigger, so the blooms are really high. It's hard to manage the size.
Very true.
And just a reminder, spring flowering shrubs, you can prune them during the dormant season, but pruning them soon after flowering, a couple weeks after the flowers fade, then you'll maximize your floral display the next spring.
Good point. Well, it's a little late for that for the lilacs, but
next year. Late winter, early spring, do your pruning.
Exactly. And we've got Deborah from Racine on the line. Go ahead, Deborah.
Hi. I have a Munstead lavender plant. I was able to grow it from seed this spring, and so it was small, so I put it in a pot on my patio, and it gets full sun, and it's doing great, and it's like, you know, like about a foot high in the pot, but now I'm worried that I waited too long to transplant it into the ground, so I wanted to get your thoughts on that, and then two, I also wanted to get any tips or advice on where to plant this. I'm in Racine, so we're by the lake, so we're fairly, you know, that have the cooler springs and some, they say warmer winters, but I don't think so. But
it's all relative.
Doesn't feel like it, right? I'm really glad. Yeah, Deborah, I'm glad you brought up Munstead and Hidcote are the two hardiest varieties of lavenders that we should be growing here in this state for the best success. Phenomenal. I've had good reports from, I've lost a couple after a few years of phenomenal. I even lost a couple of my lavenders, one lavender this year, but the rest did okay. So you're right. Full sun, good drainage. When I lived in Milwaukee, I'm going to talk to you about what to do with your potted lavender. But when you're looking for a spot for lavender, full sun, well-drained soil. When I was in Milwaukee, I had amended my soil. It was in pretty good shape, but it took me a couple of years to find a spot. It was a slight slope, west face, so I had really good drainage, and I was able to grow and keep my lavender alive. And my soil is much heavier. Now I'm in sand, so I don't have to work so hard. For your lavender, I think you're fine if you can get it out and get it going. Otherwise, I would suggest if you can, a couple things you could do. You could sink the pot into a vacant part of the garden and then plant it next spring. And that you could do in a sheltered location so you have a little more control over the environment. That might be the easiest thing to do if you have a space where you could do it. You could also, if you have an unheated garage, as long as you water whenever the soil is thawed and dry. Now, I have to tell you, I never get everything in the ground. So I have kind of these from insulation boxes that I put all my unplanted things in and water them whenever the soil is dry. Good luck. One year I had a bull move in and destroy half of the stuff. So I use plants get animal repellent when I save them in the garage because of that problem, because it was like a lot of work to just take them to the compost pile.
Oh.
It was very sad. So you probably could get by getting it in the garden, but if you're feeling like, you know, I don't want to take a chance, sink the pot in a sheltered location in fall. Once the ground freezes, you know, just a little mulch on the soil. And then in spring, what I find with lavender, too, is I wait because a lot of times you'll have some stems die. You know, everything above ground died on me this winter, but I got new growth eventually coming up, so don't give up too soon on it.
Yeah, I have to say that my mom, Mumstead?
Yeah.
Yes, that's what I had, and that one did die, and I'm still looking at it going, come on, you can do it. There's got to be something left. But the one right next to it, which is a different variety that I can't remember, that also looked dead, but it did come back. Not looking great, but it did come back, so you never know what those plants.
Right. I'm a believer you wait. I had two very established Hypericum St. John's wort, our native, that I've had for years, for 10 years. And I waited till about a few weeks ago that they were dead and get rid of them. Well, that was just ridiculous, but I couldn't. I was just so disappointed. They were so favorites of bees and mine.
That's so hard. I once in a while I have something that didn't come up one year, and then the next year there it comes. Which of course I've already put something else there, so now I got both of them.
A nice companion plant.
Yes, it is. It's a nice problem to have, actually. So good luck, Deborah. And I think it's great that she was able to grow them from seeds. That's pretty impressive.
Oh, I know. So. I'm impressed.
Very much so. Well, we did get an email from Jen in Madison to say that her peach tree developed raised bumps on brightly colored spots on the leaves this spring, and her peaches never got bigger than a fist size, which is pretty decent size. What can she do to make sure that the tree is okay?
You know, it sounds like peach leaf curl, and I've had several calls about it. It is a fungal disease, and sometimes I'll see it some years and not others, so a good cleanup in the fall. You know, raking the leaves, getting rid of those out of the area because that's a source of infection. It, you know, you may opt to treat with a fungicide. And again, extension. And the reason I keep promoting it is I find written material is so helpful or on the internet where you can access it and review it before you have to spray or pick up a product. There is some information on peach leaf curl from UW. I think it's Brian Huddleston wrote a fact sheet on it, or it's under the peach growing peaches in Wisconsin. I had some brown rot on some of my plants in the past, and I choose not to spray, and I just try to do some cleanup, which I could probably do a better job. So I think I'm with you. A fist-sized peach in Wisconsin, pretty
right?
impressive.
I think so,
and,
too.
Yeah, peach leaf curl can have some impact on the productivity, but if it's a minor infestation in your first year, probably not. So I'd say enjoy your harvest and then check out that growing peaches in Wisconsin. And the UW Hort, I think, is where Brian's fact sheet is on peach leaf. Or if you just do UW peach leaf curl, you'll get there.
Yep, for sure. Well, we got about a minute or so left before we have to say goodbye. Melinda, tell us once again when you'll be at the state fair and how to find you.
I'll be at We Energy Energy Park, and as you mentioned, Jill, it's kind of a little green oasis in the fairgrounds, and there are benches you can just sit and look at the gardens. We've planted some cool things in there, including our companion planting garden. I'm speaking on companion planting at 10:45, 1:30 new varieties, 4 o'clock vertical gardening. And at the end of the first day of fair, I'm blasting over to Ebert's Greenhouse Village in Exonia for Ladies' Night. It's 4 to 8. They postponed it because of threatening weather yesterday. And I'll be there as soon as I can get there till close. It's a fun event. And gentlemen, I've seen gentlemen at the ladies' night also. Food, games, lots of fun, shopping, of course. And I'll answer questions and sign books.
And warning, there will be plants here that you want to take home.
I stopped by to pick something up, and I had to pick a few plants up from my garden, too.
Exactly. I have a problem with that. Melinda, thank you so much for once again spending some of your time with us and our listeners.
Always a pleasure, Jill. Take care.
You too. That, of course, was Melinda Myers. She's a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author, columnist. She basically does everything. Stay with us because we are going to be talking about fertilizer. How can it go bad? What should we do with it if it does? So we'll be back in just a sec. Stay with.
Thank you.
Does fertilizer go bad? You know, I have to admit, I'd never even thought about it until a press release arrived in my email box recently. I'm Jill Nadeau in for Larry today on The Larry Mueller Show. We have the author of that press release with us today. Her name is Valerie Smith, and she is a content strategist for Sod Solutions. And we'll ask her about fertilizer shelf life, find out how to store it, and how to know when it's time to get rid of it. What questions do you have about fertilizer? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Valerie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. Allergies, but I hear you have the same problem.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that time of year.
It certainly is. Allergies and fuzzy hair, but we'll get through it. So you're down in South Carolina, but when it comes to fertilizer, does it really matter where you are?
No, it doesn't really matter. Sometimes the seasonality will matter in terms of if the grass is dormant during the winter versus in the summer, but that's more about the grass or your plants that are growing in that region in general. But no, the fertilizer isn't going to matter from location to location.
Okay, wanted to get that set first. So what are the different types of fertilizer, and do they have different shelf lives?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of different types, and they're all different brands, so shelf lives can vary, but there's definitely organic fertilizers. They're synthetic. They can be liquid. They can be granular. Sometimes you can get a weed and feed product that's going to have an herbicide and a fertilizer in it, and these products will differ with shelf life depending on the brand or depending on that type of fertilizer. So for example, organic, that's going to have a shorter shelf life than synthetic might. And it can start, once it starts to go bad, it can emit a foul odor or show signs of mold growth, that sort of thing. Whereas with these other fertilizers, whether they're liquid or granular synthetics, they're going to last a little bit longer, sometimes depending on the brand, 5 to 10 years.
Okay. Now, how can you tell if the fertilizer that you are buying is fresh?
So sometimes you can look at it and see if there's going to be an expiration date. Again, that's going to depend on the brand. However, some other things that you can do is, for the most part, if the fertilizer is going to be carried in the store, it's pretty much going to be fresh.
Although I've noticed it's in some garden supply shops that the dust on some of those things gets a little thick. So that's probably a good clue.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure.
Now, what is it that affects fertilizer longevity?
There's a couple of different things that can affect it. There's definitely your moisture and your humidity, and that can affect both granular and liquid. There's temperature extremes, whether that's hot or cold, and that's going to mainly affect your liquid. It can affect your granular, but mostly that's going to affect your liquid. And then the way that you store it. So when you're storing your fertilizer, you definitely want to keep it in a cool, dry place that's off the ground. And I say off the ground because you're going to want to keep things from like happening in terms of flooding or something else spilling. There could be pests. So that's kind of why I say off the ground. You want to keep it away from direct sunlight. And that's kind of going back to that temperature extreme. Away from extreme temperature fluctuations. So heat can actually break down nutrients, and freezing temperatures can cause the separation or like crystallization of nutrients and liquid fertilizers. As well as keep it in a garage or shed. If you don't have a garage or shed, I would recommend using a closet or some sort of utility room, a weatherproof bin on patios or decks or even basements if they're going to stay dry. So airtight containers made for moisture and making sure that those containers are tightly sealed.
Now, up here in Wisconsin, of course, we have very cold winters. Is it okay to leave that fertilizer out in the shed when it's going to freeze?
If the shed is going to be temperature, if it's prepared for temperatures like that, yes. If not, then I would consider bringing it into your garage or some other basically just place that's going to keep moisture, freezing temperatures at bay, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So for us, a lot of us have basements, so that probably would be a good place for it, although it could be damp. So.
If it's going to be damp in your basement, I wouldn't recommend it. Or I would put that in a weatherproof bin of some sort.
Sure.
Or some sort of sealed container within your basement.
Now, should you be concerned about maybe the safety of fertilizer that's old?
In terms of, like, hurting your plants or...
Well, yeah, that. And also, I mean, can it start bubbling and cause problems that way?
Okay. Yeah, I get what you're asking.
Yeah.
So, not really. I mean, you don't want to necessarily pour any sort of fertilizer down a drain or anything of that nature, because it's going to contaminate waterways and the environment. But it's not, I don't think it's going to do any of that sort of thing where it's bubbling or causing too much harm. I mean, you obviously don't want to, like, ingest it or anything of that nature.
Whether it's old or not, don't
ingest. Right, right, whether it's old or not. But your organic fertilizers can actually cause more problems, whereas your liquid and granular synthetic fertilizers are just going to be ineffective in terms of how they affect your plants. So an organic fertilizer is going to eventually, over time, show signs of mold growth or even bacteria. And that, once you apply it on your plants, spreads into your plants and could possibly damage them, whether that's like your garden or your grass. Mm-hmm. Whereas with your synthetic or granular fertilizer, it's basically just not going to be as effective. If there's too much nitrogen in a liquid fertilizer and it separates from the rest of the liquid in that fertilizer, you could potentially have a nitrogen burn on, like, your lawn or your plants. But for the most part, no, that's not going to cause too much damage.
Now, we've been talking about these different types of fertilizer. Why don't you go through them again and kind of explain a little bit about how you can tell what you have, and are they used for different things?
Yeah, that's a great question. So granular is typically traditionally known for a longer shelf life. However, liquid fertilizers, there are plenty of liquid fertilizers out there on the market that will last just as long. And most of the time people will say, you might hear on or even read online that granular fertilizers will have it's basically what you call a controlled release of nitrogen, basically. But liquid fertilizers can do this as well now. So honestly, it just depends on what you prefer. A liquid fertilizer is really awesome because it's light. We have our own liquid fertilizer called Lawnify, and it actually connects to your hose end. So it's lighter to carry. It's easier to use. Whereas with a granular fertilizer, it's going to be heavier to lift. You have to use a spreader, and spreader settings, I don't know about you, but for me, it can be super confusing. Yeah. And when you have a homeowner who is just, you know, aren't super lawn savvy, they don't really know what they're doing. They just know that they need to apply a fertilizer. You know, that it becomes more complicated. Whereas if you have a liquid that you can hook up with an even distribution, then you there's less room for mistake, basically. And when you're spraying, like Lawnify, for example, Lawnify comes with enough nutrients to cover 5,000 square feet. And a lot of your liquid fertilizers that are around that same size are going to cover an area like that. Whereas with granular, there could be a variation of different coverages that you could put on, like, your lawn or your garden. But again, you're dealing with spreader settings. You're dealing with how much you have to pour in. So it gets a little bit more complicated. That's not to say granular fertilizers are necessarily bad or anything, but your liquid is typically easier to handle. And that can be organic or synthetic. So your organic fertilizers can also be granular or liquid as well.
So that makes it even more complicated.
Right.
So what is considered organic?
Organic could be your compost. It could be manure. Different things like that. That's just not going to be a synthetic chemical that you're using.
And with those, you said basically kind of use your nose and your eyes. If it looks bad,
yes,
it probably is.
Yeah. You'll definitely know. It'll emit a foul odor or even show signs of mold growth. Once you start smelling that or seeing that, that is a very clear sign that you need to go ahead and get rid of it. And sometimes, again, depending on the brand, there will be expiration dates. Your organic is not going to last as long as your synthetic, but your organic might be more for the people who are trying to be super eco-conscious. But again, if you buy the right synthetics, you're also doing pretty well, because there's synthetic fertilizers out there that use the exact right amount of nutrients that aren't going to leach into your waterways. Their liquid fertilizers, for example, are going to have a way for nutrients to be a little bit more absorbed faster and more efficiently, especially like with Lawnify, we use catalyst technology. And what that does is it nanosizes nutrients so that those nutrients are absorbed really fast into the plant. They're not just sitting in your soil. It's quick and they're more effective.
And we don't have to worry about rainwater carrying it off somewhere where it won't it's not supposed to be.
Correct, yes.
We're talking about fertilizer with Valerie Smith. She is a content strategist for Sod Solution. What questions do you have about fertilizer, maybe even lawns? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us again on Monday at 11. We'll be taking a look at the advances of non-medical X-ray technology. Amazing what's being done. And then, of course, the weather guys are going to stop by, which is always fun. Fun conversation. Right now, we're talking about fertilizer. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can always send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. So you were talking about how to store fertilizer, and you're basically saying it should be someplace that's a little bit stable temperature-wise, away from moisture. Anything else that we should be thinking about?
In terms of storage, I think that pretty much like really sums it up. But there are some other things that you can do to be proactive with this, and that includes labeling your bags or your bottles with a date of purchase if there's not an expiration date that's going to be on your product. So that's definitely one thing you can do, is actually like write the date on the package, whether that's granular, liquid, organic, synthetic, it doesn't matter. That way you kind of know how long this fertilizer has been sitting in your storage. You can also check the packaging. You mentioned earlier something about telling how old a fertilizer might be when it's sitting in the store. Mm-hmm. Check the packaging to make sure that it's actually intact before buying. Because like you're saying, if you're looking at a bottle of fertilizer and you're seeing dust, maybe try to see as best as you can what the seal looks like on the liquid fertilizer. Or if you're looking at a granular bag, are there holes in it? Does it look like it's been torn or ripped? So that's also something that you can look at. Another great tip is not to overbuy your fertilizer. And that's kind of what I was saying a little bit earlier about Lawnify and just liquid fertilizers in general, is that you get only what you need. Sometimes those liquid fertilizers will cover something like 5,000 square feet, whereas granular might be much more, or you might overapply, you might underapply, you might burn through all of the granular, and you have more chances for mistake with a granular fertilizer. Checking the expiration dates and periodically shaking or stirring the fertilizer. So if you know that you're going to have that fertilizer sitting in your garage or shed for a while, you can take a liquid fertilizer and shake it every few months just to make sure that it's staying mixed pretty well. Same with your granular. You can go in and stir it and make sure it's not clumping. And if you have a liquid fertilizer, try to keep the bottles upright as much as possible.
Oh, yeah. You don't need liquid leaking for sure. So what if we've, you know, gotten our fertilizer down off of our shelf, we've used it already, and then we realize that it had been expired? Should we refertilize? Should we just wait and see? What would be your suggestion?
I think that's a great question. It honestly depends on what the state of the fertilizer looked like. So for a granular fertilizer, you can tell typically if it's going bad because it's going to start clumping or hardening. If you take those clumps and like actually drop them in a bucket of water and they dissolve, it's still good. So if you're going and applying a granular fertilizer and those clumps are just not breaking up, you're going to run into struggles applying it to begin with. And that should pretty much hint off like, hey, this fertilizer might not be good anymore. With a liquid fertilizer, you might have that what's basically called where the fertilizer will break up. You'll have it'll separate the nutrients and the other liquid in the fertilizer and sediment over time. You can try shaking it, and if it mixes very well, it's still good. However, if not, that then it's pretty much bad. So to answer your question, when someone actually applies it anyway, this has been applied and it's already bad. I would suggest holding off before fertilizing again and seeing how your grass or your plants respond. Because if there's going to be some sort of burn of some sorts, like there's too much nitrogen or there's too many chemicals that didn't mix properly and it burns like your lawn, for example, you're not going to want to apply more fertilizer. So I would wait a couple weeks before applying anything again.
Okay, that makes sense. Now we do find out we've got bad fertilizer. Like you said, don't throw it down your drain. What is the appropriate way to get rid of that fertilizer?
So this will depend on the type of fertilizer. You have your synthetic and then you have your organic. Your organic fertilizer might be compostable. But if not, I would recommend throwing it away in the trash and double bagging just in case for leakage. Leakage. So the label will say most of the time on an organic fertilizer if it can be compostable. And that's also going to depend on your local guidelines and where you live. And that changes by wherever you're located. No, you don't want to pour any sort of liquid down the drain. Like we said earlier, that's going to contaminate waterways in the environment. Or you can call your local waste management agency. Sometimes they'll accept the materials or sometimes they'll give you more details about what you can do with it in your area.
That's great advice. They're always helpful when you have a question like that. So now you're talking about when you buy fertilizers, there's usually a set of three numbers on the fertilizer.
Yes.
Explain what those are.
Yes, so those are your NPK ratios, and that stands for nitrogen, potassium, and or nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, basically from like your periodic table, right?
Right.
so that's what's called your NPK ratio. Your nitrogen is what's going to help your grass grow and turn green. Your phosphorus is going to help with several things, but primarily like root development, and that's your middle number. And then your potassium, that last number on there, is going to help with a bunch of different things, including stress and being able to stand up to different, you know, disease. It could help with a bunch of different things. So those are your three primary like macronutrients, and that's what those numbers stand for. However, if you're looking at the label, sometimes you'll see those three numbers on the front, like right front and center of a package. However, sometimes you can also just go to the back and see all the exact like nutrients that are going to be located in this fertilizer contained in this fertilizer. So you can see the micronutrients under there. Sometimes you'll see like iron, manganese, and a bunch of different things.
So how do you figure out what you need for your lawn or for your garden?
Sure. The best thing I would suggest is a soil test. And you can do that. You can either order one online or go to a store and pick one up, or you can do that through your local extension service at your university. I would highly recommend doing that because that keeps you from applying nutrients your lawn doesn't need and potentially just letting those nutrients sit in the soil because it's not being absorbed. You could also, with the soil test, you're going to be able to see what nutrients your lawn is either or garden lacking or needing more of versus has plenty of. That way you're not wasting your time and money on fertilizers that aren't going to do anything.
Yes, great advice on that. Now, you work for Sod Solutions. And like I said, you're down in South Carolina, but you have products and stuff that you probably send all over the country.
Yeah, absolutely. We have our e-commerce division, and that's where we're basically selling to the consumer or the homeowner. And that's what Lawnify really is for. But we also have grass plugs, which is a great way to either start a new lawn or you could fill in bare or damaged spots without having to like completely resod, for example. We sell turf grass as well and certain control chemicals.
So you're talking about plugs like hair plugs, right? So you can fill in those bare spots.
Yeah, like grass plug. Yes. Yeah. Basically the same sort of idea. Yeah. Yeah. So if you have a part of your lawn that is just not performing well, either disease killed it, the disease is gone, you've treated the disease, or insects have damaged a certain spot, or a certain grass is just not growing well in those areas, you can grab grass plugs and fill in those spots. But we also have a turf grass licensing division to our company. And that's primarily what Sod Solutions as a whole is known for. where we'll partner with universities and grow improved varieties of turf grasses. And then our growers or farms will then grow the turf grass and we license that out.
And you have your own grass seed brands, right?
Yes, we have Lawnify Bermuda Grass, Lawnify Santee Centipede, and Lawnify Paspalum. Correct. Yeah.
So how do you
those are all warm season grass seeds? So I don't know how
they're probably not going to work up here yeah. for us. But how do you go about creating a new seed?
Creating a new seed. I don't know that we really create the new.
Blend. I mean.
So we have what we do is we have our vegetatively grown grasses that will then grow the seed, and we'll use that seed to put into a container.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I think we understand what you're saying. What else? I was looking at your website, and you've got some really good information about growing grass. Tell us about some of that.
We have a consumer-facing blog called Sod University. We also have a newsletter that goes out weekly that's free to basically anybody. And it's about lawn care. It could be about, we have different categories on that blog. There's lawn nutrition, there's pests, there's disease. There's information about new lawns versus fixing problems with old or a lawn that's currently established. There's information about like mowing and technology. A bunch of different things in the blog.
Yeah, there's a lot, like you say, how to lay it and all kinds of things like that. Weed control. We just had a question earlier about weed control. What is your suggestions for keeping lawns weed free?
I would definitely start with your cultural practices. And what that means is using fertilizer so that your lawn is dense and thick and chokes out weeds, because weeds, just like your grass or even in your garden, are going to need oxygen, water, and sunlight. So when you have a really healthy lawn, it's going to choke weeds out because and outcompete them. So if your lawn is stressed from things like disease or pests, weeds are more likely to pop up because it's not growing as well. So definitely take a practice where you're fertilizing, you're mowing properly, you're watering properly, and just taking good care of your lawn. However, there also is a pre-emergent, which will prevent weeds, and then there's post-emergence that will treat currently existing weeds. And those are both weed control products or herbicides. I would suggest doing a pre-emergent because you're spending less, and that's preventing weeds before they even show up. But there's also post-emergence available that you can apply to control currently existing weeds.
So how did you get involved in the job that you do? What's your background?
That's a great question. I sort of fell into it, to be honest. I graduated from Clemson University, and my degree was in communications. So I knew I wanted to get into marketing and content strategy, and I started doing content strategy here, and I sort of fell in love with it. You kind of think turf grass and like what's so cool about turf grass, but there's also nature and biology and the environment, which is a really cool aspect of it that I really enjoy learning more about and even writing about. Because to be a content strategist, you really have to learn the content or the information of not just the industry, but the products and everything that you're selling, everything that you want to teach consumers about, the questions that they have. You have to have documentation or even customer support tickets to answer with documentation for that. And so originally I fell in love with content strategy and just communications, UX, that sort of thing. And then once I started learning more and more about turf grass, the environment, your lawn, that sort of thing, I fell in love with that as well.
I love that. That's great. It's nice to have to talk to someone who has passion for what they do. One thing I wanted to ask, how long do you usually suggest a grass be cut? How tall should the grass be?
So that's going to depend on your variety. And I think for you guys, you mostly have like a cool season grass. So you're going to have your bluegrass or your fescue.
Yes.
And I would say anywhere between 2 to 3.5, maybe even 2.5 to 3.5 inches. You never want to remove more than a third of the leaf blade at a time during one mowing. But I would say that that's the ideal height.
So,
and in the summer, I would actually keep the grass a little bit taller because that's going to help with your roots growing deeper into the soil to help with heat.
Wonderful. Well, that is such great information. And Valerie, we really appreciate you taking some of your time to be with us. And again, she's with Sod Solutions. So you can just go to sodsolutions.com and find a lot of really great information. Thank you. Thanks for joining us today. And we want to thank our whole team, Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaud, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, and of course, Larry Mueller. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for being with us. And we will be back next week.